You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to a podcast with diabetes therapy entitled Aldosterone and Mineralocorticoid Receptor Antagonists in 2021, a Paradigm Shift. Today, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Murray Epstein, Professor of Medicine Emeritus in the Division of Nephrology and Hypertension at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Epstein.
Thank you very much, John.
As an introduction to proceedings, I'd just like to ask for your thoughts on progress in the treatment of diabetic kidney disease over recent years.
What I'm going to do today is to share with you some very major advances that have impacted not only nephrology, but I would say the entire cardiorenal space, really an extraordinary forward trajectory on our ability to treat our patients with diabetic kidney disease and their associated cardiovascular and renal complications. And in medicine, indeed in life, we have metrics. As many of you know, for many, many years now, the American Society of Nephrology and the National Kidney Foundation have put out or promulgated guidelines. The acronym is the KDIGO guidelines, and essentially it builds on relatively new innovations in our ability to treat patients. And what I've done on this slide is give you a timeline. And I think one thing stands out loudly and clearly. You can see that going from the KDIGO guidelines in 2012, there was an 8-year gap before the next set of guidelines were promulgated and published. That's been the norm. But look at what happens after 2020. There have been so many innovative changes with respect to a number of new drug classes that the new guidelines will be coming out less than 2 years later in the first quarter of 2022. And the reason for that is the essentially emergence of two major drug classes, the SGLT2 inhibitors that many of you are familiar with, and in addition to that, a new class of agents, the novel non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. And we have one that was approved by the Food and Drug Administration just a few months ago. And the name of that drug, the generic name, is finerenone. So the bottom line is the 2-year interval between KDIGO guidelines were in 2020 and in the first quarter of next year speak to the rapidity of innovation in diabetic kidney disease.
Moving on to today's main topic, could I ask you to explain the role of aldosterone in renal physiology?
There's been also another major paradigm shift. Our concept of what aldosterone does in both everyday volume homeostasis and as a modulator or mediator of primary aldosteronism, or it goes by the acronym of Kahn's syndrome. And very simply, what you can see that angiotensinogen, also termed renin substrate, is elaborated by the liver, that renin released by the kidney catalyzes angiotensinogen, and that in turn forms angiotensin 1, and then ACE, angiotensin-converting enzyme, released from the lungs, and now we know elsewhere as well, acts on angiotensin 1 to cleave it to form the vasoactive peptide angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2, very simply, acts directly on the blood vessels, stimulating vasoconstriction. So the old paradigm, the one that I learned in medical school and probably many of you in the audience learned, was a role for aldosterone and the renin-angiotensin system in two settings: maintaining normal everyday volume homeostasis, and in addition to that, if it goes awry, to actually promote hypertension. And the old paradigm that angiotensin II is a stimulant, a secretagogue, acting on the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone, and that in turn acts at the level of the kidney, the renal tubules, to promote sodium retention and conversely potassium excretion in the distal convoluted tubule. Well, this very neat package has changed dramatically in the last 2 years, and it's not merely of academic interest, but rather, I think it speaks clearly to the everyday clinical practice of everyone who's listening here, primary care physicians and healthcare providers, as well as specialists. And that's one of the messages that I'd like to share with you today.
And how has the understanding of the role of aldosterone changed over the past 30 years?
Okay, to contrast the role of aldosterone over the last 30 years, what it was, what most of us learned in medical school in 1990, 1995, and our understanding of it today in 2021. And we can share or essentially concentrate on a number of new innovations and understanding for the role of aldosterone. That aldosterone is merely one of several drivers of aldosterone secretion. It is not merely the only secretagogue. That aldosterone is one of many physiological ligands for the mineralocorticoid receptor, whereas 30 years ago, we thought it was the sole physiologic ligand. That we were taught years ago that aldosterone primarily elevates blood pressure by sodium retaining effects, thereby leading to volume expansion. We now know that that's a simplification, that rather aldosterone raises blood pressure by a number of mechanisms, primarily by its actions on the vasculature and indeed in the central nervous system. We also were taught that MR antagonists, and the one that most of us learned back in medical school, spironolactone, the steroidal MRA, acts by blocking the binding of aldosterone to the mineralocorticoid receptor. We now know that overactivation of the mineralocorticoid receptor is a major determinant of progression of chronic kidney disease, indeed heart failure, via an array of multiple mechanisms, thereby promoting injury, specifically inflammation and fibrosis. So again, importantly, and this bears down on how we manage patients, many patients in our practice, there has been a paradigm shift in our understanding of the role of aldosterone and the importance of mineralocorticoid receptor activation. And we now know that this is where the money is, if you will, in terms of a wide array of target organ injury.
Could I just ask you to talk a little about primary aldosteronism and its prevalence?
This goes back probably 50 years to the seminal work of Jerome Kahn at that time at the University of Michigan. And it was very neat. And this is the classic view that primary aldosterone was manifested by hypertension, a substantial increase in blood pressure, that it was associated with hypokalemia, present, we were taught, in over 40% of patients, and usually perhaps somewhat less in APA, that there was a lack of edema in this setting. And the reason for that, very simply, was the mechanism of aldosterone escape, which I'll get back to later in my talk, leading to an increase in natriuresis and diuresis. And finally, that aldosterone's excess resulted in metabolic alkalosis, hypomagnesemia, and mild hypernatremia. So again, if we were sitting in an office with our patient in 1990, what we would look for telltale signs is hypokalemia and substantial hypertension and metabolic alkalosis. And we were also taught, and very importantly, that primary aldosteronism is a rare and categorical disease. Well, there's been a not only great, I would say a huge paradigm shift. This year and last year, our understanding of primary aldosteronism has been completely revised, and it was best summarized in a landmark publication by a group of major investigators in the field, Brown et al., published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2020. And essentially, I've summarized what the differences are. The prevalence of primary aldosteronism is not rare, but the prevalence is high, and importantly for all of us in clinical medicine, largely unrecognized. Furthermore, that severe hypertension or hypokalemia, the dogma that we were taught in medical school, are not prerequisites for the diagnosis of primary aldosteronism. Rather, it can frequently be detected not only in normal kalemic hypertensive patients, but indeed across a very wide spectrum of blood pressure alterations. So essentially, the observations of Brown and Carey and their colleagues have served to redefine primary aldosteronism from a disease that historically was identified as rare, infrequent cause of hypertension to what we now know it is today, a common syndrome that plays a pivotal role in the pathogenesis of essential hypertension.
How are aldosterone and the mineralocorticoid receptor involved in the progression of chronic kidney disease?
Well, let's get back to the other facet of my talk today, which is the role of the mineralocorticoid receptor. Well, let's delve into that in great detail. We were taught originally that overactivation of the mineralocorticoid receptor was modulated by a single ligand, aldosterone, but that's incorrect. Now we know that there are an array of ligands and non-ligand activators of the mineralocorticoid receptor. In terms of ligand activation, not only aldosterone, but cortisol as well, there are a range of non-ligand activators of the mineralocorticoid receptor. RAC1, hyperglycemia can do it, and obviously that's very relevant to our management of patients with diabetic kidney disease, and sodium excess, a high salt diet, can do that as well. When the mineralocorticoid receptor is activated, a number of inflammatory and fibrotic pathways are essentially implemented. And our current treatment is aimed at blocking that trajectory to avoid or to block inflammation and fibrosis. I've depicted a number of drivers of chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes progression. Inflammation and fibrosis, importantly, but in addition, alterations in hemodynamics, for example, an increase in glomerular capillary pressure, which in turn can drive fibrosis and inflammation. And finally, metabolic disarray, that is, poor glycemic control, can also do it. So what we have is a convergence of several mechanisms: aldosterone or MR-activated mediated inflammation and fibrosis, abnormal hemodynamics, and finally metabolic disarray, primarily inappropriate or poor glycemic control, all of which act to promote, to drive the progression of diabetic kidney disease.
We know that ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers are widely used in the treatment of CKD. So why not just rely solely on these agents to block aldosterone and prevent progression of CKD?
Very simply, that simple maneuver theoretically should prevent progression of chronic kidney disease. Well, there's a fly in the ointment. One of my close friends and colleagues, who's a major figure in the world of medicine, Jan Stassen in Belgium, as a young investigator 40 years ago, did a simple study. What he did is treated a number of patients with not large, but I would say massive doses of captopril, the first of the ACE inhibitors. And what you can see very simply, he used doses as high as 600 milligrams a day. No one in their right mind would ever use that. But this was the early days of the era of the ACE inhibitors. We didn't know much more than that. And at that time, that was not considered inappropriate. But look at what happened. With massive dosing of captopril, 600 milligrams a day, there was indeed a suppression or reduction in plasma aldosterone levels. But then look at what happened at month 1, 2, and 3. Despite continuing treatment with massive ACE inhibition, there was an escape. And essentially, aldosterone escaped from the inhibitory effects of ACE inhibition and reverted back to pre-study levels. The take-home message is that RAS inhibition alone does not suffice to block aldosterone. Well, I mentioned the term aldosterone escape when I shared with you our understanding of primary aldosteronism or Kahn syndrome. Well, this depicts that very, very nicely from a study, again, one of Jan Stassen's colleagues in the Netherlands. And very simply, we're looking at what the relevance of aldosterone escape might be to subsequent progression of chronic kidney disease. What you can see very simply is they divided their patients into two groups. One that escaped the inhibitory effects of ACE inhibition and a non-escape group. And look at the decline in GFR on the y-axis. Patients who escaped with a reversion of aldosterone levels back to pre-study levels, these were studies carried out in type 1 diabetes with diabetic nephropathy, they had a greater or more exuberant decline in GFR. Bottom line, take-home message, prevalent aldosterone levels, which are not blocked, promote a more rapid decline in chronic kidney disease with a more rapid progression in the decline of eGFR.
How do the mechanisms of action of non-steroidal MRAs differ from those of steroidal MRAs?
Well, I mentioned that one of the reasons for our actually implementing new KDIGO guidelines in the first quarter of 2022 is the emergence of a new class of agents, the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, the novel non-steroidal. And let me try to share with you what's new, what the differences are. What I have depicted on the right is the classic MRA or aldosterone blocker that all of us were taught in medical school, and that's been a mainstay of our clinical practice, spironolactone. And on the left, the prototypic novel non-steroidal MRA, finerenone. And what I've done here very simply is summarize that there are differences between the new third generation MRA, finerenone, and the first generation spironolactone. Pharmacologically, finerenone has a bulky nature that allows it to bind to the MR in a way that prevents the MR from becoming or adopting an agonist conformation. And secondly, compared to the non-steroidal MRAs like spironolactone and more recently eplerenone, finerenone has full MR antagonist activity, whereas the classic steroidal MRAs have partial MR agonist activity, which is undesirable. So again, pharmacologically, without getting into too much detail, it's important to understand that the new non-steroidal MRAs are able to act or to promote blockade in a more unfettered or unchained mechanism, which obviously is relevant for progression for chronic kidney disease, and indeed in the diabetic patient for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
How is finerenone hypothesized to provide kidney and cardiovascular protection?
What I've done is summarize the multiple mechanisms whereby the new third generation non-steroidal MRAs typified by finerenone may provide both renal, kidney, and cardiovascular protection. Essentially, finerenone acts to block the acting on the mineralocorticoid receptor. It acts to block the transcription of pro-inflammatory, pro-fibrotic genes in various cell types. As an example, we can see the kidney and we can see the specific cell types, the podocyte, the mesangial cell, and the macrophage. And we can see the fibroblast example, and on the tubule, the epithelial cell. All of these are impacted in a beneficial manner to retard, to block, to interdict injury, inflammation, and fibrosis. That in turn acts to slow, to retard progression of kidney disease. So what we're doing is we're buying extraordinary amount of time for the patient to put off the day of reckoning in terms of progression to end-stage kidney disease. I think to summarize, this is a very major innovation, a very major contribution to our treatment paradigm. And indeed, let me bring it up to date, summer of 2021, based on two major clinical trials conducted globally in 45, 50 different countries with thousands of patients. One was Fidelio and the other one was Figaro, based on their ability to reach their pre-specified endpoint. The Food and Drug Administration in the United States in July of 2021 approved finerenone for the management of patients with chronic kidney disease in the setting of diabetes. So again, a major step forward. And again, this will be incorporated in the KDIGO guidelines that I alluded to in my introductory remarks. Thank you all for your attention.
Okay, I think that concludes our podcast. Thank you, Dr. Epstein, for your time and insights today. We hope that this has been of interest to our listeners.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.